This is the 21st from Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been less than a month since President Joe Biden was inaugurated, but he's already taken several actions against what he once described as the number one issue facing humanity, climate change. In the short time he's been in office, the president has signed 29 executive orders, including three pertaining to the environment, while most notably rejoining the United States to the Paris Climate Agreement. But many scientists worry our planet is on a collision course with climate change, that it will have irreversible and deadly consequences. And it might be time to start thinking not just about mitigation, but adaptation. My guest, David Pogue, has structured his latest book as a how-to manual for surviving the chaos. You may recognize his name and voice as a science and technology correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. Here he is from a recent piece.
2020 has been a year of nonstop crises.
The coronavirus has infected Wall Street.
Some wore masks as protection from one epidemic while demanding an end to another.
For a while there, it was almost possible to forget an ongoing crisis that used to have our attention, climate change.
Parts of Newport Beach are flooded tonight.
But nature found a way to remind us. In the Midwest, punishing 100-mile-an-hour winds. In the Southwest, a brutal succession of floods and droughts. On the coasts,
Delta is bearing down on the Louisiana Gulf Coast.
A freakish number of devastating hurricanes. And in our western states,
the combination of the high heat and dry brush makes for explosive fires.
Historic mega fires that sent a plume of ash and smoke all the way to the East Coast.
Pogue's latest book is called How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide to Surviving the Chaos. Hello, David Pogue. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, our lines are open for this conversation. We want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Have you taken steps to respond to climate change? Maybe you've started doing something in light of that, or you've stopped doing something, or maybe you just have a question for David Pogue. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. So, David, I want to get into your book in a bit, but first, as I mentioned a moment ago, in the early days of the Biden presidency, he signed a number of executive orders aimed at addressing climate change and the environment, including rejoining the Paris Agreement. I wonder, how important are these actions, do you think? Is it too little, too late? Is there still time?
Well, if we can meet the Paris Agreement goals, it would be something. The Paris Agreement is non-binding. There's no punishment if a country doesn't meet the goals. It's largely a message that we're sending both to Americans and to other countries around the world that the problem with pulling out of climate change action in the last 4 years was that the other huge polluters like China and India didn't take us seriously, thought, well, if the U.S. isn't going to do anything, why should we? So I would say there's a good signal being sent that, yeah, we're in this, we're going to help fix this.
So what we're talking about is policy, right? And a lot of climate policy and the way we think about climate still has to do with addressing climate change through mitigation. I noticed Bill Gates has a book coming out, and I'm sure it's going to be about nuclear power and, you know, creating huge carbon vacuums to suck the carbon out of the air. It's a very sort of big picture thing that I think a lot of people can get overwhelmed thinking about. Why did you decide to go with a sort of more personal, practical guide? Can you talk about that distinction in thinking about the climate crisis?
Yeah, I was inspired by this quotation from John Holdren. He was Barack Obama's senior science advisor. And he once said, when it comes to climate change, we have three reactions we can have. There's mitigation, which means trying to stop climate change. There's adaptation, which means trying to cope with what we've got. And there's suffering. And how much we do of the first two will determine how much we do of the third. So as far as I can tell, everything that's ever been written about climate change for the public is about mitigation, how to make your carbon footprint smaller, how to stop pumping out greenhouse gases. And that's really important, and that's fantastic, and we need to keep doing that hard and as fast as possible. But nobody ever looked at the second part of that formula. No one's talking about adaptation. And for many years, climate scientists didn't like the word because they were worried that the public would therefore throw in the towel and say, okay, we're giving up on mitigation. We can't do that. But if you look out the window, you can see that the climate has changed and it's not going back during your lifetime. So there are disasters coming our way. We don't know exactly what the date will be, but they are coming our way. Why wouldn't we prepare? Why wouldn't we adapt to what we've got?
Yeah, we look out our windows here in Illinois and we're experiencing the polar vortex restructuring, which used to be a fairly rare thing. We had a segment on the show a couple weeks ago that this is going to be more common, where we're going to have these Arctic temperatures here. That's on one end of the spectrum, and then heat waves in the summer as well. So in the piece, the clip, I should say, from your piece on CBS Sunday Morning, we heard a few minutes ago, you talked about some of the crises we witnessed in 2020, these extreme weather events. And you talk about how the climate crisis has been overshadowed in a way by several other crises facing the country, notably the pandemic. I wonder, what did 2020 tell you about the climate crisis and our ability to respond to a big problem like that?
I mean, 2020 was an award winner for all kinds of years, tied with the hottest year ever measured on the planet. It featured the highest temperature ever measured on the planet, 130 degrees in Death Valley, most number of hurricanes, so many hurricanes, we exhausted the alphabetical list of boys and girls' names and had to go into Greek letters. It told me that nothing has changed in terms of the change in climate, even though our eye was taken off the ball by the pandemic. hilariously, this book, How to Prepare for Climate Change, was supposed to come out in August, and the publisher wisely thought, well, the public will have crisis fatigue if we make it come out in the middle of a pandemic. So they delayed it till now, thinking, well, of course, the pandemic will be over by February. So the climate has marched right on without us, and it's really fantastic that the public elected a president and an administration who considers it a top priority.
Do you think that the way we responded to COVID, though, does that make you more or less optimistic for the way we might respond to the increasing problems with our climate? I mean, the political, you know, the fact that something like, you know, that I think at a different time, I can imagine that something like everybody should wear a mask would have been taken as public health guidance. Maybe that's naive of me and not as sort of a political statement. But does that complicate your view of how well we will take the advice in your book and, you know, do what needs to be done to adapt?
Well, here's the great thing for the book. When we say climate denier, and I think that's what you're getting at, it's not clear what exactly we mean. Are we saying people who don't think the climate is changing at all? I think that number of people is vanishingly small at this point. I think more typically it means somebody who doesn't think human activity has anything to do with the climate breakdown. So even that number, though, is getting smaller and smaller. It was 32% of Americans put themselves in that category, that this is all natural cycles as of a year ago, and that's been dropping steadily every year. And as David Wallace Wells told me, he's another climate author, he said, in this environment, anytime you can get over 50% of the voting public to agree on anything, you're ahead of the game. And he reminded me that 25% of Americans believe that aliens walk among us. So 32% is a pretty good rate, and it continues to shrink as the number of people who oppose taking action.
Well, okay, so your book focuses a lot on individual action, things we can do in the face of this crisis. What do I do to prepare for climate change, as opposed to, as we were talking a few minutes ago, this large-scale policy, sweeping reforms. But I do want to ask you about our sort of personal culpability in the climate crisis. I recycle. I mean, I turn off lights when I leave the room. But, you know, I'm using equipment right now to talk to you. I'm working remotely, as many of us are these days. The equipment I use to do this radio program from my home is powered by burning coal in a plant a few miles from my house. The coal is transported there by an endless convoy of tractor trailers that bring it in from a mine a ways up the interstate. Do we have individual culpability in this crisis? Is that something we need to address?
What you as an individual can do to mitigate the climate crisis, I would say, on its face is limited. Changing your light bulbs to LED is not going to stop the wildfires and hurricanes. That said, there's a huge reason to do what you can. And by the way, you didn't mention the number one thing that an individual can do, which is stop eating as much red meat. Cows, it turns out, are an unbelievably huge source of greenhouse gases. It's not even carbon dioxide. It's methane, which is 80 times worse at blocking the heat. One cow burps up 12 gallons of methane an hour. They are just the worst. So if you can scale back a little on the red meat, that does make a difference when multiplied by the millions. But the other thing is the social norms effect. Study after study has shown that if you're driving through a neighborhood and you see a lot of solar panels on the roofs, the rate of adoption of solar panels among the other citizens is much higher because you're seeing other people taking a certain behavior. So if people see what you're eating, see how you're taking public transportation, seeing what the solar panels, seeing the steps you are taking to mitigate climate change, the cumulative effect is to affect other people around you. So that's a good reason for individuals taking what action they can, because en masse, we can make big changes.
Interesting. Signaling, I guess you might call that.
Exactly. Social contagion, they call it.
Yeah. All right. Let me reintroduce you. Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with the science and technology writer and CBS Sunday Morning correspondent David Pogue. His latest book is How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide to Surviving the Chaos. Our phone lines are open for you, 800-222-9455. We want to know if you are preparing for climate change. Maybe you've made changes in your daily life, things you're doing now or things you're not doing now. Maybe you are eating less red meat and contributing to less methane in the atmosphere. Or if you just have a question for David Pogue, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And David, the first chapter of your book deals with acclimating to climate change and preparing oneself mentally. It reminded me of this article I saw not long ago. I think it was in Vox. It said the scariest thing about global warming is this idea of shifting baselines, where there's this growing complacency. We get more and more used to the severity of the weather that's out there. We begin to accept it instead of taking action. I'm reminded of that old expression about how you boil a frog. I wonder, what are your thoughts on that?
The first chapter is about addressing eco-despair and climate anxiety. And, you know, my editor calls this the first uplifting book about climate change because, I mean, depression has been defined not as just thinking that your situation is miserable, but thinking that your situation is miserable and you're helpless to change it. And that's a key point, because when it comes to the changing climate, it's extremely distressing to a lot of people. For one thing, as you mentioned, personal accountability, there's this implication that the American way and our drive to consume and to acquire is responsible. You know, we have to take on this guilt and we have to change our ways. So the first chapter is about how you can overcome climate anxiety, depression, guilt, which a lot of people are feeling these days on top of all the other emotions we've got. And, you know, the prescription is pretty simple. It's taking action. So whether it's taking the actions in this book, you know, where, how to invest, how to insure, how to shore up your house, how to talk to your kids, how to fix your garden, or if it's just a matter of taking political action, joining a group, writing an editorial, writing your congressperson, all of those things, taking action, it means taking control of the situation and sleeping better at night.
Yeah, and not falling prey to despair, I guess. Seeing that, you know, I guess if you're, as you say, whether it's improving the siding on your house or reading over your insurance policy, at least you are doing something to ensure that you personally are ready for what's to come, even if we as a society might be falling down.
I should add, Brian, that during the pandemic, we saw a drop in greenhouse gas emissions. Last April, it was down 17% worldwide, the greatest drop in greenhouse gas emissions since the Industrial Revolution, when we started burning these fuels. And what that tells us is that that nature does respond really quickly if we as a society make changes. So we do have our hand on the knob it's not a hopeless situation. We can make change. I mean, of course, it was for a terrible reason. It was because everybody was out of work and the factories were standing empty. But it does show that changes we make can have a quick response.
Okay, we need to take a break here. My guest is David Pogue. His latest book is How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide to Surviving the Chaos. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. Our phone lines are open at 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers on the line. We will go to you when we come back from our break. You're listening to The 21st. More to come with David Pogue after this. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're speaking with David Pogue. His book is How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide to Surviving the Chaos. This is quite literally a how-to guide. It's got that feel and shape to it, the sort of rounded corners, just like you'd have a manual for using your iPhone or something like that. This is things, sort of practical things that everyday people can do to get themselves ready for what seems to be coming to us in terms of the weather. I want to go to the phones at 800-222-9455, and I'm going to start on line four, Mike in DeKalb. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for having me. Yeah, I was calling actually in regards to, I actually farm here in northern Illinois, and we've noticed a relative shift in the varieties we use to plant, especially in corn, where we're going to more fuller season varieties to accommodate for climate change because of the changing times. So we've actually noticed that our growing season's longer, which we've actually adapted our varieties, and we're actually receiving higher yields because of it, just because of that climate shifting further north. We're somewhat projected to be like an Arkansas climate someday, is what some people say.
Oh, wow. And that's in northern Illinois right now. So that is quite
right,
a
eventually,
shift.
If you know, the full impacts of climate change are felt. And, we're doing as much as we can on our farm with, you know, low tillage practices and things like that, and producing ethanol, which helps pull carbon out of the atmosphere. And then, you know, it ends up getting burnt back again in vehicles, but it's actually capturing it again, you know, through our carbon cycling. So,
sure.
You know, we do a lot of things on our farm specifically to try and address those issues that are also economically viable, too. So I think with some smart technologies and new methods of doing things, we're actually trying to do our part to, you know, do what's right for the environment.
All right, Mike, thanks for calling in and sharing that. We appreciate it.
That is really cool. Sorry.
Go ahead, please.
It's really cool to hear from. I just spent 2 years writing about agricultural farmers. It's really cool to hear from Mike, who's actually in the thick of it. I should say that for Illinois and Iowa, you know, the prediction exactly as Mike says is that some crops will actually do better, both because the growing season is longer and because more carbon dioxide in the air is something that plants actually like. On the other hand, the flip side is that we're getting much more brutal heat and much more intense rains. And when they alternate, you know, the intense rain and then the drought, you get hard, dry ground that can't absorb the rain when it comes. So that makes it much harder to grow. So, you know, it's a split decision on agriculture.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about that, because you write that, you know, the farming could take a hit. We're going to have these extreme heat days. Yet, on the other hand, there are parts of the Midwest, at least the northern Midwest, that could be some of the more climate-proof regions in the U.S. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's right. Your listeners happen to have shrewdly thought ahead and parked themselves in one of the safer areas of the country when it comes to extreme climate disasters. You know, that if you have a choice of where to settle, and 40 million people a year do move in the United States, you want to think, if you want to consider climate as one of the factors, the West Coast is really tough with the wildfires and with this perpetual drought they're in. The East Coast has the superstorms. The Gulf Coast has the hurricanes. The South, I mean, the heat is just unbelievable. And in Phoenix, people have oven mitts in their glove compartments because the steering wheel is too hot to touch.
Oh my gosh.
So really, the sweet spot of the United States is the Great Lakes area. I mean, the great old Rust Belt cities are poised to have this huge renaissance as it becomes the... I mean, no place is completely safe. In Illinois, you still will have pretty brutal heat waves, and flooding is going to continue to be a problem, but you don't have the really apocalyptic stuff like the wildfires and the hurricanes.
You know, that segues greatly into another caller we have on the line, Anne in Peoria on line two. Thanks for calling in.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I was reading a lot about how parts of the planet will actually become unlivable in terms of producing food and a climate where humans can live. So those people are going to start to migrate to other areas, and that's going to eventually lead most likely into wars and other societal disruption. How do we plan for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Anne. So, yeah, David, you're right. I mean, if people follow the advice in your book and start relocating to the Midwest and the northern middle states, what are we going to do with that?
Well, for the United States, I think that's okay, because those cities were built for much bigger populations than they have now anyway. You know, Cleveland, Buffalo, Duluth, Madison, they were all they've got room to grow. I think Anne might be referring more to the global scale of climate migration.
Sure.
And that is a real nightmare scenario. The United Nations estimates that it could be hundreds of millions of people by the middle of the century leaving the uninhabitable, ungrowable regions for areas where they can live and grow and survive. It's already happening, actually. I mean, they say that the Syrian war was in part caused by the climate change. You know, people in rural areas were baked out of their ability to grow and got pushed into other places. And that was where the conflict arose. And that'll happen more and more. One guy I interviewed for the book said that we will someday in the United States build a wall on the southern border, but it has nothing to do with people taking our jobs. It's just that the people from the super hot, you know, Central America regions are just going to need to flee to live. These are, of course, apocalyptic visions and worst-case scenarios, and assume that it's business as usual and we don't do anything to help. I guess the one bright side is that we're already talking about it and we're already addressing it, and the United Nations is writing about it.
I want to reintroduce you. This is the 21st. My name is Brian Mackey. My guest is David Pogue. His book is How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide to Surviving the Chaos. And there's a chapter in your book, as we've been talking about the Midwest and what effects we might see here, particularly in Illinois. There is a chapter on preparing for heat wave. There was a Moody's report that came out about a year and a half ago that predicted that counties in central Midwestern states, like particularly Western Illinois, Eastern Missouri, will experience the greatest increase in extreme temperatures, particularly extreme heat events. I wonder what should people be doing to prepare for these sort of ongoing heat waves where the wet bulb temperature gets to dangerous levels?
Yeah, I should mention that I didn't start out an expert on any of the topics on this book. It was all
sure.
based on expert interviews. And one of the things that I learned from the experts is that heat is the biggest killer of climate change. It's not flooding, it's not wildfires, it's heat waves. And, you know, it's just a disaster for anyone who's already weakened with a disease or with age or with extreme youth. You know, it drives asthma up. It sports players, especially, you know, high school football, that thing, wind up in the emergency room far more often. I think it's not quite as dramatic in terms of footage and news as a fire or a hurricane, so maybe we don't take it quite as seriously. But we know how to deal with heat, right? Stay in air conditioning if you can. drink water, hydrate nonstop. One of the weirdest effects of the climate gas era is more kidney stones. The rate of kidney stones is going up because when the weather is hotter, we drink less, we concentrate our salts and our kidneys more. Anyway, nobody wants to hear about this. But but there's also a lot to be said for design, both of cities and of homes. You know, in the old days, before there was air conditioning, we had to use cleverness to design our homes to avoid being hot in the summer. You know, the old southern homes had really high ceilings on the premise that heat rises, so we, down at human level, keep cool. They had wraparound porches, they had flow-through breezeways from one end of the house to another, and in the air conditioning era, we've forgotten all that, and it might be worth taking another look.
Yeah, sleeping on the porch, I know stories from my grandmother about that. and even my parents, I guess, when they were younger, did not have air conditioning and would have to have the windows open and maybe sleep sort of outside with screens, which does actually remind me of, I love it when a stat gets sort of reframed or the way a common fear gets reframed. And you talk about the threat from deadly animals, and you have a line in there that the deadliest animal on Earth is not the snake, rabid dogs, or sharks, it's the mosquito. And you talk about, you know, which, again, sharks kill 6 people a year, mosquitoes kill about 500,000 people a year. And you write how we're used to associating things like malaria, yellow fever, dengue with faraway places. But this is something that, according to your map in the book, Illinois might even have to, you know, start thinking about these diseases carried by mosquitoes.
Yeah, not everybody is upset about the changing climate. The mosquitoes are having parties. What's happening is that the winters are no longer cold enough or long enough to kill off the mosquito population during the colder months, and so they love it. They're marching northward. By one estimate, 5 miles a day. And so all the diseases that they carry are coming to new places. It means more sick people in more places is the bottom line. And, you know, there are ways you can prepare, of course, because that's the subject of the book. But the simple one is, you can know when they come out. They tend to come out when the sun's coming up or down, so mornings and dusk. So if you're going to go for a hike or something, it's the middle of the day you want. And of course, repellent. Put on DEET repellent. It's not bad for you. It doesn't kill anything. It's not a poison. It's just a repellent. Mosquitoes hate it, and they will stay away from you.
Good advice there. Okay, I want to go back to the phones. We can see if we can get in one more call here. James is on the line in Bloomington. James, thanks for calling in.
Hi. I just wanted to build upon what he had said earlier about the importance of the change of diet. I switched to vegetarian in 1990 after reading John Robbins' Diet for a New America, but I'm reading more and more books and just finding out just how much environmental damage is associated with the livestock industry and just health in general.
And so did you become, James, a vegetarian because of concerns about the environment in particular? I'm not familiar with the book you cited.
Yeah. John Robbins' book he focused on health, cruelty to animals, and the environmental damage associated with the livestock industry. And over the years, I'm migrating to becoming a vegan to try to move towards a entirely plant-based diet. And there's just a wealth of books out there right now and films that have been produced that just really emphasize how important diet is and its impact on the environment.
Okay, James, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate that. Go ahead, David.
And if I could just chime in real quick, I would second that. One-third of the Earth's non-frozen surface is dedicated to cow grazing. A third of its land, and that's why they're burning down all the forests in Brazil to make more cattle grazing land. So if going full vegetarian is too much for you, at least do the protein flip. That's where, instead of considering dinner, what slab of meat will be in the middle of the plate surrounded by other things, you think the other way. You think of it mainly being rice or noodles or vegetables with some bits of meat in there as an ingredient not as the main thing. It's possible to cut back even if you're a red-blooded American.
Okay, we only have about 3.5 minutes left in our conversation, and I do want to talk about a couple more points you get to in the book. One is protecting your children and talking to your kids about climate change. I know you're a father as well. What should we think about in terms of parenting in this time of climate change uncertainty? Ultimately, our children are going to be left to deal with the consequences of our inaction.
I will admit to having been wrong when I went into this territory. I want to protect my kids. I don't want them to stress out. I would be inclined to minimize the bad news from the climate disasters. But my experts, all child psychologists, spoke to 5 of them. They all told me I'm dead wrong. Your kids know. They've heard it from YouTube. They've heard it from their friends. Some of them hear it from school. If you try to minimize or sugarcoat the problem, they're going to think that it's even worse, because why would you hide it from them? So you have to be honest, but you can also be honest about the progress we're making. You know, the world's greatest scientists are working on the problem. You know, we've just elected a president who wants to fix it, and we will always be, you know, we the parents will always be with you to guide you through whatever comes our way.
You know, I mentioned a couple of times that this is a thorough and deeply researched book, and there's so many things people can look at doing, being, you know, big things like changing the sort of weatherproofing of their house, looking at the siding and things like that, to microchipping dogs, making sure your phone is prepared the right way. I think it can be a little overwhelming for people sometimes to think about this. If you had one piece of advice for our listeners, like what could they do right now after this show to, like, step one, after buying your book, of course, to try and start thinking about getting ready for climate change.
All right. Step one, as boring as it can be, you've got to look at your insurance policy. You got it a long time ago. I know you don't know what's in it. You got it to be as cheap as possible. At this point, 18% of Americans who live in flood zones have flood insurance, and everybody else is a sitting duck. That's because homeowners insurance does not cover flood damage. It doesn't cover flood damage. You are probably not covered for flood damage. So review your insurance policy. There's nothing worse than coming back to your dripping or smoking damaged home and realizing that you're underinsured.
Wow. All right. Well, that is unfortunately just about all the time we have for this segment. You do end the book. I'd hope to get in a question on hope. I don't know if you have sort of just a few sentences, because you do end the book with sort of, you know, encouraging people not to be so dire, maybe just sort of encouraging people to how they can think of taking charge of this situation.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of good news. Even during the Trump administration, 438 mayors, 55% of the American population, 25 states had all agreed to stay in the Paris Accord goals. Even without the federal government, corporations, big companies, industries are all working and changing to reduce their climate emissions. So there are some big guns pulling to solve the problem. We will get there. It'll take 50 years to decarbonize, but it will happen.
David Pogue is a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. You can see his reports there. And his book is How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide to Surviving the Chaos. David, thanks so much for being with us on the 21st today.
Thank you.
More to come after a short break. You're listening to the 21st. Stay with us.